from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierenkopf, and Stephen Hayward.
Well, hi, everybody. It's Steve Hayward going rogue or going solo today on the Powerline podcast. We suffer this massive coordination problem and never can seem to get the four of us together at the same time, even virtually in the same place. In any case, we've got a special guest today. I caught up with John Yoo at Berkeley Law School to talk about all the things going on right now with Trump and other things in the law, including the Neil Gorsuch nomination. We'll get to that shortly, but a few opening comments and observations on what is going on this week. Lots of news to cover. There's news every 5 minutes in the administration of Donald Trump. I've been thinking a lot about how Trump is the first president that I can remember, first new president, who hasn't had the traditional honeymoon of, you know, good feelings and dampened partisan strife. Maybe that's fitting for a guy who's on his third marriage. You wouldn't expect someone on his third marriage to get a honeymoon. But I'm thinking this might well work to his advantage in the long run. These low poll ratings in some ways show that the battle lines are drawn and that in some respects he has nowhere to go but up. It can go either way. I'll have some longer thoughts on this coming on Powerline in a few days if I can. On the other hand, what can't he do? I've noticed that even Lena Dunham is losing weight because she's so upset about Trump, which makes me think that Michelle Obama must be very envious. My tweet of the week is that the problem with America in the internet age is too many Americans are living beyond their memes. You can always expect a regression to the meme any moment now. Meanwhile, a couple days ago, you may have noticed the big fuss about Mitch McConnell shutting down Senator Elizabeth Warren on the Senate in the midst of her attack on Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. McConnell's taken a lot of heat, including from the Washington Post, which wrote the following. I'm just going to quote the Washington Post here. McConnell gagging Warren is one of the best gifts she could have received, and her birthday is not even until June. It solidifies her bona fides as a fighter for progressive causes. You know, she has a book coming out this spring called This Fight is Our Fight. It looks to me and to everyone else like she is positioning herself to be a candidate for 2020. Now, maybe McConnell giving her gifts are not necessarily the kind of gift that this faux Native American would want to receive. I mean, after all, she makes George McGovern look like a raging right-winger by comparison. Things could go the other way, but look, it seems to me that Trump could do much worse than to run against Elizabeth Warren in 2020. And even the Washington Post figured that out. A little later on in the same story, they said the following, and pardon me while I read it here a little bit. Quote, McConnell has a well-earned reputation as one of the savviest political operators of the post-war era. So it's hard to imagine that he didn't know how his move would play. To channel Marco Rubio, we should dispense with the fiction that McConnell doesn't know what he is doing. He knows exactly what he is doing. So you cannot just dismiss it as a fit of pique. Perhaps he is strategically trying to elevate Warren. Maybe he thinks that life will be harder for the 10 Democrats up for re-election next year in states Trump carried if Warren, not Chuck Schumer, is the face of their caucus. She has been getting less buzz recently compared to some of the younger whippersnappers who also want to run. Maybe, seeing this, McConnell concluded that Warren is ultimately the most beatable potential Democratic nominee in a head-to-head with Trump in 2020. He plays the long game that way. Just ask Merrick Garland, end quote. Well, even the Post has figured out that Warren is likely a disaster for the Democratic Party. So go Mitch. Once again, he's outsmarted all the smartest liberals in the room. That moves us on to the Gorsuch confirmation. We'll probably do a regular Gorsuch confirmation watch on the website. But as I said last week or the week before, you really owe it to yourself to follow Ed Whalen's minute-by-minute dispatches at Bench Memos at National Review Online. Ed Whalen refutes the nonsense from the left and all the attacks on Gorsuch practically before the pixels are set on the screen. But we'll have a few thoughts on some aspects of this. I think I know how the confirmation hearings are going to play out. It's so well known that Gorsuch didn't just take a law degree from Harvard, but also earned a PhD from Oxford University, where he's a student of someone well known to some academics for his rich teaching on natural law and natural rights, a guy named John Finnis, who's still alive. I think he's emeritus now at Oxford. I dusted off his book from 40 years ago called Natural Law and Natural Rights to look through it. And those of you old enough to remember the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, the first round of them before Anita Hill showed up, may remember there was a lot of controversy about then-Judge Thomas's affinity for the idea of the natural rights philosophy of the Declaration of Independence. In the beginning of that hearing, the very first question came from the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, a Delaware senator you may have heard of named Joe Biden, who waved aloft a book. It was Richard Epstein's book on property rights called Takings. And he waved that book around from the dais of the committee room and essentially asked Clarence Thomas, are you now or have you ever been a reader of this book? Because Biden was going on to try and lay out the view of prominent with the left that natural rights are no longer an acceptable philosophy for jurisprudence or for America as a whole. I take up this subject, by the way, in my forthcoming book, Patriotism is Not Enough, in case you haven't heard this by now. In any event, I suspect there may be a rerun of that strategy. I would not be at all surprised to see one of the senators on the Democratic side hold up John Finnis's work, find a couple of quotations out of context that can be distorted, and try and embarrass or otherwise corner Judge Gorsuch about the matter. And that will be an interesting moment. You know, I quote in my book, who was it? Was it Senator Sessions? I can't remember just now, but I quote a Republican senator questioning Elena Kagan during her confirmation hearings about, do you believe the natural rights philosophy of the Declaration of Independence? And she would not answer the question. She dodged the question repeatedly, and you can see the point is that people on the left do not believe in the philosophy of the American founding as expressed in the Declaration of Independence, or indeed as you see expressed in the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court into the 20th century before the left got a hold of the law schools and the courts and repudiated the American founding. So that debate's still alive. We'll have a new round of it with Judge Gorsuch. I suspect that this Harvard-trained lawyer with an Oxford PhD will handle it superbly, might even turn a debate against the liberals. But watch this. It's going to be fun to watch, and I'm certainly going to be covering it closely. Finally, on the Gorsuch confirmation, before we move on to our special guests, what in the world is Chuck Schumer up to? He has an article out this week saying Gorsuch needs 60 votes for confirmation. Seems to be the declaration that there's going to be a filibuster, and it seems on the surface that he is daring the Republicans to repeal the filibuster. Or invoke the nuclear option to get rid of the filibuster. But I wonder about this. You know, Schumer should not be underestimated. He's a very smart man. He knows the political difficulty he's in with so many vulnerable Democratic senators in the next election. It would at all surprise me if what he really wants to do is preserve the filibuster for the next court nominee, which is arguably much more important than this one. Gorsuch does not change the balance on the court as it has existed, and the court has it's been a split court with some wins for conservatives and some wins for liberals. But if Kennedy retires or if Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires or Justice Breyer, who's also 79, retires, then what you will see is the balance of the court would shift decisively to the right. That's when you want to mount the barricades with a filibuster if President Trump were to name a second conservative. Whether he will, I discuss with John Yoo here in a couple of minutes. I have a prediction about this. I think Democrats will try and mount the filibuster, and I think Schumer, as minority leader, is going to try and find 8 Democrats who will vote against the filibuster so you can proceed to an up or down vote on Gorsuch, at which point all 48 Democrats will vote against Gorsuch. So they'll be able to say, by the way, I voted for Judge Gorsuch before I voted against him or something John Kerry-like. But the point is, I think Schumer knows he's going to get through one way or another. He has to placate his base. So he's drawing seemingly a line in the sand saying he has to have 60 votes. But I think behind the scenes, Schumer's going to be trying to find 8 votes who will allow the vote to proceed and vote against the filibuster. But he'll do this quietly. So that's what I think. That's my prediction. You can take it to the bank or to Las Vegas along with your bet on the Falcons. And without further ado, let's now proceed to this week's special guest here on the Powerline Show. Joining me now is John Yoo, the Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. And oddly enough, my classroom teaching mate, since we're actually teaching a class on executive power today. So, John, welcome to the Powerline broadcast.
Thanks, Steve. And it's been great to teach with you so far this semester. But the semester's not over yet. We still have to see what grade we're going to give each other.
Well, it's still early. That's right. So let's start with current events. You know, typical of the New York Times to take after Trump for in an op-ed a few days ago for his misuse, supposedly, of executive power. But wait a minute. The article's by you. I mean, John Yoo. And typical of the New York Times, then, you might say, to find a conservative to attack Trump on executive power. They like to do that at the Times. But look, I mean, you were critical of Trump all the way up before the election, you and Richard Epstein on the Law Talk blog. Why don't you, for listeners who didn't see the piece, sort of recap what your concerns are about the way Trump is conducting himself?
Well, part of the piece, I was trying to be careful to say that some of the things Trump has done are constitutional and legal, but some of the things he's doing are either going too far or skirting right up against constitutionality or maybe even crossing the line. So it's not 100% condemnation of Trump, as perhaps many conservatives would have agreed with before the election. So I focused on, as everybody is now, on the immigration order and relations with Mexico. So, for example, I think one thing that is unconstitutional would be President Trump trying to withdraw from NAFTA, build a border wall without authorization or appropriation from Congress, and figure out some way to slap some kind of tax or tariff on Mexican goods to pay for the wall. I think under Article 1 of the Constitution, which we were belaboring in class today, Steve, says only Congress can appropriate funds. And the Supreme Court has also said only Congress is in charge of border control. They can delegate that power to the president. But if President Trump wants to build a wall or a walking path or an amusement park or a national park along the border, Congress has to pay for it. If President Trump wants to pull out a NAFTA, NAFTA is very peculiar. It was passed by Congress as a statute. It's not a treaty, actually, in the formal sense. Congress has to participate. If President Trump wants to slap some kind of tariff or a tax on Mexican goods, Congress has to participate. So in that area, I think President Trump has gone too far in what he's suggesting. But the thing I think that's the most difficult, of course, is the immigration order, which, you know, is going through the courts as we speak. Some things are legal about it, and then I think some things are could be unconstitutional. The thing that's legal about the immigration order is, I think, the president, it's a hard case, it's a hard question, but I do think the president can suspend immigration from specific countries. There are two laws in the immigration laws. One says that you can't discriminate on the basis of national origin or nationality in running the immigration law. So that cuts against Trump. But there's another provision that says the president can suspend the immigration of classes of aliens, which is undefined, if the president believes it's in the national interest. So if you just look at those statutes, it seems to me there's a conflict. I would resolve that in favor of the president. There are judges today, right now, who are resolving it against the president. But that's a close question. The thing that troubles me is the idea that Rudy Giuliani put out in public, and then some advisors from the White House have been saying in leaks, that what Trump was really trying to do was get himself a Muslim ban, and that this was the way to do it that might survive judicial scrutiny. If that's actually true, then I think that's unconstitutional.
Yeah, that was a rather unfortunate thing for the mayor to have said, I think. Let's talk a bit more about the spending business. It's gotten very complicated how spending is done these days. But Obama, in various cases, didn't have trouble finding money for things, or, in fact, even, what do we call it, ICE now. Not, it used to be Immigration and Naturalization,
INS.
Now it's ICE. But, you know, they found some money because they have some kind of self-funding mechanism that's been delegated to them when Congress wanted to cut off their funds for processing Obama's immigration orders, right? So yes, there's some latitude there somewhere, and so are they going to take this
but
back?
But not $12 billion.
Right? So that's
the
a
problem
lot of latitude.
Is that the walls, if the wall was just a few hundred thou here
right.
and there, you could probably what you call reprogram funds, move them around. But $12 billion is what the wall at a minimum apparently will cost. I don't think you can find that just you can't find lying, lying under the papers at Trump Tower on the desk.
Not even in the couch cushions at Trump Tower, right. Let's talk a little bit about your, I think, creative idea for what the cultural impact of Trump is going to be. The great popular culture sensation under Obama was what? The Broadway play Hamilton.
Yes.
And so what can we expect during the Trump years from Broadway?
So you heard it here first on the Powerline blog. Race to your word processors to get on to the next big craze, which is going to be a Broadway play about Madison, right? It's got to be, because the reason why the Hamilton play musical was so popular, I think, was because Obama was in office and Obama was pressing the limits of executive power, and the cultural and university and the journalistic liberal elites loved Hamilton because he's the justification for things Obama was trying to do. Now that all those elites are anti-Trump and they're going to be anti-executive power, watch, it's going to flip on like a dime. Well, who's the big critic of executive power? Madison, the author of the Helvidius Papers, right, against Hamilton's Pacificus Papers, and the person who really thought that the president really was just there to carry out the policies of Congress. Remember, and I think one of the reasons Madison was a terrible president was he thought that only Congress could decide on war and peace. And so when Congress rushed us, I think in whatever you think about the Iraq War, Afghanistan, Vietnam, I think strategically the worst, dumbest strategic war we've had was the War of 1812.
Yes.
And Madison thought, oh, that's up to Congress to decide. I can't stop the Congress from driving us into a war that could only be disastrous for the United States. And so he refused to try to stop Congress from declaring war on Great Britain.
So he kind of deserved to have his house burned down.
Right.
That'll be part of the play, right?
Yes.
That could be a great part,
yes,
of the play.
And the great heroine, Dolly Madison, who knows what song she'll sing while she saves the Washington portrait,
right,
from the White House. And, right. It'd be great.
Let's talk about Neil Gorsuch for a bit. Neil, of course, right? Is that,
yes,
Neil?
Neil Gorsuch.
Yes. I think you told me that you don't know him well, but you were clerks at the same time on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal. So
yeah,
take it from there.
For a long time, I think he's a great pick. So I think conservatives are really divided about Trump, right? And I think a lot of conservatives decided to make peace with Trump because of his promise to appoint a conservative to succeed Justice Scalia. And he put out that list of 21 judges, apparently devised by the Federal Society and the Heritage Foundation. And I think that put a lot of conservatives at ease when we saw the names on that list. I certainly was put more at ease about what Trump might do. But now that Trump was in office, who knew whether he would keep his promise? And, you know, up until the last possible minute, it looked like the other person who might have gotten the nod would have been Judge Hardiman of Pittsburgh, who may be conservative, but he has no opinions, really, suggesting he is, and apparently was on the short list because Trump's sister likes him a lot.
Who is a liberal, we're led to believe, right?
A judge appointed by Bill Clinton to the same court as this judge. So not to cast aspersions on Hardiman, but if Trump had picked him because of what his sister was whispering in his ear, that would have only fulfilled the worst nightmares of conservatives,
right,
who signed on with Trump. But to Trump's credit, I think he kept his word. I think he has picked someone who is a conservative. I wouldn't say he's exactly like a Scalia Bork. I think he's actually much less doctrinaire in the sort of Scalia Bork positivist view of the Constitution, that there's no unenumerated rights, that the court should always defer to the elected branches of government. You know, Gorsuch, one thing that he's, I think, probably most well known for now is his call for the end of judicial deference to the administrative agencies.
Right.
Which is really 180 degrees contrary to what Scalia and Bork thought. Gorsuch seems to be rather self-confident that the judges shouldn't defer to the elected branches when it comes time to constraining what seems to be the never-ending growth of the regulatory state. And then the other thing that's really interesting about Gorsuch is he went to Oxford to study to get a doctorate.
Ah, right.
And he got it with a fellow named John Finnis, right? Probably the world's great natural law, natural rights philosopher, which is very unpopular, Steve, in the academy. I'm sure.
Oh, I know. Yeah, oh, believe me.
This is not a popular way of thinking.
I've read Finnis's great book on the subject a long time ago now. I just got off the shelf the other day to get back into it.
Wow, really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, good for you. Well, I'm not going to join you there.
Okay.
but you know, Gorsuch went out there, studied with him, and wrote a book attacking euthanasia and assisted suicide for violating natural rights.
Right.
That's really interesting because I would say, I don't know what you think, Steve, I bet we haven't had a follower of natural right on the Supreme Court since the resignation of Justice Sutherland in whatever it would have been in the late 1930s.
Well, except for the justice you clerked for, Clarence Thomas.
Yes.
And I mean, I think you remember the hearings, the first round of hearings. Whereas I put it, then Judiciary Chairman, a guy named Joe Biden, opened the hearings by waving Richard Epstein's book, Takings, and essentially asked Thomas, are you now or have you ever been a reader of this book? I mean, it was unbelievable. And then attacked him for his friendly comments about natural right.
When he had attacked Bork for not believing.
Exactly. Yeah, oh, yes, that's right.
This is 4 years before.
My prediction, by the way, is that somebody, I don't know if Al Franken has the wit, so to speak, to do this. But somebody, I think, is going to try to attack Gorsuch on his Finnis connection.
Oh, I would think so. Well, I mean, you don't even have to infer it. Gorsuch wrote a whole book taking this approach and saying euthanasia was always wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, in every circumstance, I think it'll be a legit. But I agree. I think, you know, Clarence Thomas, maybe Alito are sympathetic or maybe even stronger about natural and natural, but they haven't put it into Supreme Court opinions either.
Thomas a little bit. I think he snuck it in.
The Declaration of Independence, but if you look at judicial decisions, never have any of them turned on saying natural law says this and it's contrary to what Congress has said in a statute. And so, I think that's – I'm not saying Gorsuch is going to get on the court and start doing that right away, but it means the court's going to move away, I think, in a welcome direction away from sort of the arid jurisprudence of a Scalia or a Bork.
Well, the remarkable paradox about Trump is that that was the one thing he was the most specific about, is naming individual judges. Because, as you know, the trope has been, at least it was for George W. Bush in 2000, and then Rudy Giuliani said the same thing in 2008 in his brief run. They both said, if I'm elected president, I will name justices like Thomas and Scalia. And that's when I would raise my hand and say, which one? You know, they're not the same, right? And that's a distinction I know you know well and that I know well. And I'll just say I have a whole chapter about that problem in my forthcoming book about Harry Jaffe and Walter Burns. But
buy it now for Christmas.
Exactly. Or Father's Day's coming up before Christmas.
Valentine's Day.
Yeah, it won't be out in time for Valentine's Day. It doesn't come out until February 21st, unfortunately. But you can order it for Valentine's Day. I'll say that.
That's a way to make your wife really pissed off at you. Oh, there's no roses for you, but here's a book about Jaffa.
You know, I may rethink that whole suggestion. That's a good point. But really, it's kind of remarkable that Trump, who talks about the Constitution so little, except to say there's 12 articles in it or something crazy, right?
And say the Supreme Court should investigate Hillary Clinton.
Right, right. And on the other hand, he's going to be in an odd way. Possibly, we'll have to see if he gets a second appointment and who he picks. Could end up being the most constitutionalist pro-constitutional revivalist president in modern times. And go figure, what a paradox that would be.
You know, it's because – but what do you think, Steve? I mean, you've seen – you were a student of the Reagan administration. You've seen Republican and presidential administrations come and go. And isn't it usually the case that presidential candidates have to make peace – with the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and the way they always have tried to do it is through the Justice Department and Supreme Court appointments. So George W. Bush, remember, once upon a time, George W. Bush was suspected of being a moderate.
Right.
Right? And he pointed, who did he point to? Attorney General John Ashcroft.
Right.
And, you know, he put up, I think he has an unparalleled record of putting conservatives into the lower courts, certainly, and tried to do it at the Supreme Court, and just, I think, misjudged Roberts, but got it right with Alito. And George H.W. Bush, too. I think there's a lot of pressure on him to prove he wasn't a moderate by putting in conservative judges. I think that's always been a way that presidential candidates try to take care of the base of the Republican Party.
Although it may be worth saying a minute about George H.W. Bush. They clearly botched it with David Souter. Yeah. And it happened because they short-circuited the Justice Department process,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's true.
That's because, and that's what you worry about with Trump, is that his sister will get the next pick, right?
Yes.
Trump might say, ah, well, I picked this Gorsuch guy. He got confirmed. Now I got room to do something else. I mean, it seems to me that would be the worry, and we'll just have to see.
Yeah, see, I think you're really right. I mean, in a way, you know, the media and Schumer, people like that, professors are all fixated on whether the filibuster or not. But you're quite right. The real test is not this vacancy where you're just replacing Scalia with, you know, a conservative, a different stripe, but someone you wouldn't expect to uphold Roe versus Wade either. Right. The next test is actually the next seat. And, you know, if you look at this as a dress rehearsal for that next one, which will be an Armageddon of the confirmation process, even though I'm a doubter of his, you have to say Trump did well.
Yes.
Picking Gorsuch, and he uses the same approach and sticks to that list of 21 judges for the person who may replace Ginsburg, who's in her early 80s, Kennedy, who's 80, or Breyer, who's 79 now. One of those becomes vacant. You know, you would think that Trump will do well again. I mean, I think conservatives should have much more hope than they did a month ago.
Yes.
About what might happen for that fifth seat.
If he sticks with the list, yes. And we'll just keep our fingers crossed
that. But that's the thing. He's so unpredictable.
Right.
Why would we the thing that has always worried me is about what if Chuck Schumer says, say, Justice Ginsburg retires sometime in the next 2 years, and Schumer goes to Trump and says, I will cut income tax rates to 25% across the board if you actually just pick from these three people.
Yep.
And Trump wants to be reelected. He wants the economy to grow.
He's a deal maker.
Yeah, and he made the art of the deal. Can conservatives really be sure that he will? It's easy for Trump to do it now because, in a way, he's doing it before any legislative deal-making starts going on. It's fortunate for conservatives that Trump did make the pick now. But a year and a half from now, or suppose Republicans lose a lot of seats in the midterm elections, is Trump going to stick to this course then?
Right. This would be a long subject, but it's maybe it's appropriate that the first president we've had is on his third marriage is getting no honeymoon. You know, he doesn't get a honeymoon anymore at this point, right? all right, last question, and then we can let you go home. So what are you working on? You have a book in the works? I haven't asked you. What are you up to?
I'm actually working with Jeremy Rapkin.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
A fellow of your stripe in the political theory world. And we're writing a book on new weapons of war, drones, cyber, space weapons.
Robots. Right.
Yes. And not only describing what's coming down the road in terms of new military technologies, but how it should change the way we think of war and how to use force. And so our view is that, in a way, we're going to return to the way things were maybe in the 18th and 19th century, and we're going to see nations using much lower level forms of violence against each other to coerce each other rather than going to full-blown World War I, World War II style wars. And so what the Russians and Chinese are doing to us, we've been passively accepting it. So Jeremy and I, in a way, are arguing that we should strike back in the same way.
Mm, right. So what, build our own artificial islands off Coronado or something?
Well, then Peter Thiel will go move there.
I think he wants his mobile. I don't know. Well, great, John. Thanks very much for doing this, and I will see you next week.
Yeah, wonderful. See, we're going to talk about what? Andrew Jackson and the presidency. Can't wait.
And we're going to see why I think Donald Trump put Andrew Jackson's picture up in the cabinet room in the White House.
Yeah, right.
Okay, that's all for tonight. Thanks.
Thank you.
Powerline is a production of powerlineblog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.